Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. As with the first formulation of Kant's categorical imperative, when we look at the second one, which you can see here, we'll talk about that in just a second. When you look at this, you want to have some examples in order to understand how this would actually play itself out, how it would be applied. And fortunately for us, Kant provides us with four examples in the course of discussing this formulation of the categorical imperative. And his running through these is actually a bit more illuminating, I think, than his running through the exact same examples for the first formulation. This is a little bit more intuitive, a bit easier to grasp, I think, for the average person, the average student. It doesn't require you to try to go through this grand process of trying to think of, well, what if the entire world was like this, and is there any logical contradiction? Instead, what we're looking at is issues about ends and means. How is humanity being treated in this? And just to review a little bit, here's how it runs. Act in such a way that you always treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, never simply as a means, but always at the same time as an end. So what does that mean? Well, you notice that it has two parts. It's saying that you have to treat humanity in not only other people, but also in yourself. So you're a person, they're people, you have human dignity, they have human dignity. You're supposed to respect that human dignity in each person, including yourself. So that precludes certain things where somebody could say, well, I'm not hurting anybody, therefore everything I want to do is okay. Kant would say, no, there's some things that are actually not okay, even though they're not actually hurting another person, because they're actually detrimental to the humanity in yourself. The other thing that's important here is the question of whether you're treating a person as a means or as an end. And I need to clarify again here, it's possible to treat a person both as a means and as an end in the same action or decision or policy, particularly, you know, if you're thinking about in terms of a relationship, something that's structured over time that takes place in a number of different steps or sequences, it becomes a little bit trickier then. And we'll look at some examples in the next video, not in this one, which deal with that. But we want to look at Kant's own examples. There's a few other things that are important to bring up. One is he distinguishes between what he calls merely subjective ends and objective ends. And what are merely subjective ends? Well, these are the ends that we settle upon and which guide our practical reasoning, our decision-making, our choices, but really have reference only to our own desires and inclinations. They're not desires and inclinations that are held by everybody. For example, when I get up in the morning, one of the first things I do is I make myself some coffee. And you could ask yourself, well, why does he do that? Well, that's a matter of subjective ends. I want the alertness that coffee brings to me. I don't really feel myself because I'm an addict to caffeine, actually. I don't feel entirely with it until I have my first cup of morning coffee, sometimes my second cup of morning coffee, depending on how strong it is. And I also like the taste of coffee. Now, does that apply to everybody? No, that's a subjective end that I take for myself. The coffee itself can be a means to an end in terms of a larger framework, too. Why do I need to be alert and to taste something that tastes good so I can concentrate on grading early in the morning? That would be, grading would be the end, and drinking the coffee and the alertness and all that would be merely a means. Now, objective ends are ends that every rational being, as a rational being, can say, yes, that's something that we ought to aim for. So, for example, preservation of innocent life, that doesn't mean that everybody actually says, yes, I want to preserve innocent life, I want to keep people safe, or anything like that, but they ought to. As rational beings, that ought to be something that would be an end for their will. So now let's look at what Kant says in some of these examples. He starts out by talking about necessary duty or strict duty. And again, we have strict duty and meritorious duty. Strict duty towards oneself. What would be an example of that? Well, whether one kills oneself. He had that example of a person who decides to shorten his life because his life turns out to be unpleasant for him. And he says, you know, is it permissible for me to shorten my life so that I don't have to endure suffering, I don't have to endure pain, I don't have to endure things that I don't like? You know, maybe humiliation, discomfort. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be physical suffering. It could be mental suffering as well. Loneliness, for example. And he says, the man who contemplates suicide will ask, can my action be compatible with the idea of humanity as an end in itself? Here we go. An end, right? So he says, if he does away with himself in order to escape from a painful situation, so there's a goal, right? Doing away with himself to escape from a painful situation. He's treating that as an end, getting away from the pain. How is he treating his humanity? He's treating his humanity as a mere means to that end. He's using his very capacities of choice, of reasoning things out, of sort of, you know, forecasting what the future is going to be like, of being able to weigh alternatives. He's using all of that as a means to alleviating pain or suffering or perhaps even loneliness or something along those lines. So he says he's making use of a person. What person? Himself. Merely as a means to maintain a tolerable state of affairs till the end of his life. So here's what Kant says then. Man is not a thing, not something to be used merely as a means. He must always, in all his actions, be regarded as an end in himself. Hence, I cannot dispose of man or humanity in my person by maiming, spoiling, or killing. So Kant would actually say, I mean, if we wanted to think about this, some people alleviate their anguish by engaging in actions which maim themselves. Kant would actually be against that, self-mutilation. Now, he also says something here, too, and this is maybe a little bit a cop-out at this point, but I will do other videos later on where he does explore these things. He says, a more precise determination of this principle in order to avoid all misunderstandings, for example, about having limbs amputated to save myself. Like, let's say, you know, you actually get gangrene. Is it permissible to chop off your arm? Kant says, yeah, of course. But there you're not treating yourself as a mere means. You're actually treating yourself as an end. The explanation of that is a little bit more complex. And he discusses that in other works, so I'm going to put that off for right now. What about exposing my life to danger in order to preserve it? Yes, he's also willing to say that that could be allowable as well. Okay, so that is strict duty to oneself. And strict duty for Kant has to do with whether your action would conflict or not with humanity. Whether it would treat humanity as a means by conflicting with. By sort of negating it, nullifying it, placing it in a lower context. Now he says, what about necessary or strict duty to other people? The person who has in mind making a false promise to others, you remember that was the other classic example, will see at once that he's intending to make use of another person merely as a means to an end which he, meaning that other person, does not share. So to respect another person as an end means understanding that they not only have subjective ends of their own, which may not map onto mine, which probably actually don't map onto mine, insofar as our ends, our goals, our desires are merely subjective, they're probably not, you know, in complete alignment. They probably are not identical. They may, in fact, conflict with each other. We can agree upon objective ends. That's stuff that we can all share as rational beings. Now, if I'm treating another person as a means, I am, in a certain respect, treating them as a thing, not respecting their capacity to set ends for themselves. So the question here is, can I make a false promise to another person in order to get something from them? If I do that, I'm treating them merely as a means. So he says, the man whom I seek to use for my purposes by such a promise cannot possibly agree with my way of behaving to him, and so cannot himself share the end of the action. That's an interesting point to make, and we're going to come back to that in a moment. But let's go on a little bit further, and then we'll come back to that question about the possibly. So he says, this incompatibility with the principle of duties to others leaps to the eye more obviously when we bring in other examples. What are other examples? Attempts on the freedom, to enslave somebody, for example, perhaps even to kidnap them, you know, would be another example. Attempts on the freedom and the property of others. If I make an attempt on the property of others, what are we talking about there? Robbery, theft, fraud, a whole range of things. Kant says these sort of actions, when we engage in them, we're treating others as less than what they are. We're treating them as things to be used, as things that we get what we want, our ends, our subjective ends, satisfied by them, but we don't respect their ends, and we can't possibly expect them to do that. You know, if you think about fraud, for example, if you're going to defraud somebody, you have to trick them. Why? Because if they actually knew what you were up to, they wouldn't trust you, right? Now, let's go back to the possibly. Can we say this in every case? Kant doesn't go on to consider this. But what about, say, a masochist? Somebody who enjoys being humiliated, being threatened, being punished, being injured. That is, having somebody else impose their ends upon them and treat them as a mere object. Would that be what they call a defeater for Kant and his moral theory? Well, I don't think so, for two reasons. One approach that a Kantian could take to that would be to say, well, you know, a person like that just has different subjective ends, and what they're really about is getting humiliated, right? Or getting hurt. And so if you know, there's that old joke about a masochist is a person who says, hurt me, and a sadist is a person who says, no, I won't. Because the sadist is the one who wants to actually hurt the other person and inflict pain on them to contravene their desires. And the masochist really wants to have their desires contravened. If that's the case, then that is their desire, sort of a higher order desire. And then maybe their ends could be in alignment. I don't think that's a good Kantian answer. I think there's something wrong with taking that sort of approach to it. I think a better Kantian answer is to say, well, look, a person like that who's agreeing to that, who's agreeing to be used as a mere means to by another person, is screwed up in a certain way. They're whatever ends they're pursuing are merely subjective ends. They're not objective, rational ends that you know, every rational being could, in fact, share, ratify, recognize as being what they want to do. Let's go on now. So we've looked at strict duty. Strict duty shouldn't conflict with the humanity in oneself and others. Meritorious duty is a little bit different. Remember, meritorious duties are the ones where Kant, you know, and this is what meritorious duty means, not just for Kant, but for other people. It's okay if you don't do them. It's not like you've actually gone against duty. You've been immoral by not doing them. But it's better if you do them. It's a good thing for you to do it. Sort of like you don't have to give to charity, but it's a good thing for you to do it. You have a less strict duty to give to other people out of your surplus. If you see somebody starving on the street, then you do have a duty to save them, I would say, right? Maybe some people would disagree about that. But if you see somebody who's hard up and there's other people who could contribute and you know, you've got money in your wallet and you say, should I do this? There's a sense in which you should, but it's not the should that compels. That's what we mean by meritorious. And in that case, one's action ought to harmonize, he says, with humanity. So let's look at what he says here. In regard to contingent or meritorious duty to oneself, we do have duties to ourselves. And it's interesting here because Kant says we not only have meritorious duties to other people, we have meritorious duties to ourselves. We don't just have strict duties to ourselves, like don't get yourself killed. We also have meritorious duties to ourselves. Like what? Well, should I develop my talents, capacities, my intellect, my moral sensibilities, my memory, should I develop these aspects of myself? Should I engage in the process of education, whether intellectual or moral, or perhaps even, you know, in terms of trades or things like that? He says, there are in humanity capacities for greater perfection. Every single one of us can make progress. And when we do that, we are getting greater perfection, as Kant says it. It's easy to get tripped up here because we tend to think of perfection as like being the acme, the one top point, right? You earn 10 out of 10. Well, perfection is also a relative term. We can say that some things are more perfect than others. You know, if we talk about a perfect cup of coffee, that's probably a very relative term. Not just relative in the sense that it's relative to the person drinking the coffee. In this case, me. This is not a perfect cup of coffee, by the way. But relative to what it is that makes coffee coffee, or makes a coffee drink a coffee drink. For instance, I would like a little bit more robustness to this. We actually bought Dunkin' Donuts coffee to fill in a gap when we normally buy very dark roast, and I'm kind of a dark roast kind of guy. I would like a little bit more body to it. That would make it more perfect. Now, human beings are like this too. We can make progress, and we can attain higher and higher degrees of perfection thereby. So, you know, for instance, as you're learning Kant, right, you are perfecting your mind. You're not, by the time you're done with Kant, you're not absolutely perfect. You're not at the acme, the highest point. But you've made some progress. You have more to contribute. You have more to put on the table. You have more to deploy on your part than you did when you first walked in the door and never heard about Kant, right? So, he says, there are in humanity capacities for greater perfection which form part of nature's purpose for humanity in our person. This might be a big leap on some people's part. Kant has a teleological understanding of nature. Nature has intended us to be in certain ways or to develop in certain ways. Kant clearly thinks that we were given these potentialities so that we could, in fact, actualize them. And that requires work and choice and determinations on our part and commitment that we have to make over and over and over again. So he says, to neglect these can be compatible with the maintenance of humanity as an end in itself. So if you neglect these, if you say, I'm just going to watch beer and play Xbox and listen to music and go out and get on the dole and, you know, pick whatever you want, right? An easy lifestyle where you don't actually have to develop yourself as a person. Intellectually, morally, maybe even physically. That is not incompatible, per se, with the humanity within oneself. But it doesn't harmonize with it. He says, it's compatible with the maintenance of humanity as an end in itself, but not with the promotion of this end. In order to really treat a person, oneself, as having full dignity, worth, you have to actually care about your own development, Kant would say. That's a very interesting thought. There's a lot of implications to that. Well, let's go on. Meritorious duties to other people. He said, the natural end which all people seek is what? Happiness. Happiness is the satisfaction of our desires and inclinations, the pursuit and attaining of our merely subjective ends, because happiness is different for each one of us, according to Kant. And he says, humanity could no doubt subsist if everyone contributed nothing to the happiness of others, but at the same time refrained from deliberately impairing their happiness. So everybody obeys a set of rules. Nobody steals. Nobody, you know, defrauds anybody else. Nobody kills anybody for no good reason. We obey a bunch of rules, but we say, screw you as far as everything else. I've got mine. You've got yours. And we're not going to help each other out. I'm not going to help you, right? That would be what he's talking about here. Humanity could exist, and there's nothing, you know, transgressing against somebody's humanity like there is when you go out and you club them over the head, right? There you're definitely treating that person as a mere means to whatever end it is that you're trying to attain by clubbing them over the head, or when you defraud them, or when you cheat, take a bribe and find them guilty or find them innocent or things like that. But he says, this is, however, merely to agree negatively and not positively with humanity as an end in itself, unless everyone endeavors also, so far as within him lies. He's not saying you have to, like, you know, give everything, but so far as lies within your power, to further the ends of others. And now, notice, these are not just objective ends, these are subjective ends. If you can make somebody's day brighter, and it's not going to actually cost you too much, it's not going to, you know, radically derail your own progress or whatever ends you're pursuing, Kant would say, well, you ought to do that. It's not, you know, you're not a bad person if you don't do that, but you're certainly not a good person. If you want to be a good person, you actually have to fulfill meritorious duties as well. To be a good person in that sense means really engaging the humanity of other people and engaging the humanity of oneself. Not just respecting it by, you know, not transgressing against it, but promoting it, trying to make things better. So he says, the ends of a subject who has an end in himself must, if this conception is to have its full effect in me, if I'm really to be a moral being, be also, as far as possible, my ends. So, you know, if I'm not into a particular genre of music, but somebody else is, and I can get them not only some CDs of that music, but also put them in touch with somebody who's, you know, really good at producing that kind of music. And I know that that would make them happy, at least in that respect. That would satisfy some of their ends. I can make those my own ends, even though I don't have an active desire myself for that. And I would say, well, if that were me, I wouldn't really get anything out of that. As a matter of fact, I might see it as a waste of time. I can grasp, because of grasping the humanity in another person, I can grasp that that's their ends, and I can make those, in a way, through practical choices and actions, I can make those my own ends. Now, there is one other example that Kant doesn't talk about in this section, but it is an example that he talked about earlier in the groundwork. And so it's one that I want to bring up. And I want to close with this one because this is a really good example. So he talks about the shopkeeper who gives fair prices. This ties in really well with business ethics, right? Because one of the things that you see coming up over and over again in business ethics, both in business ethics courses and in the sort of broader community, is you should be ethical because it's good for business. You should do the right thing and not break the rules and don't cheat people and give people fair prices because you'll get some sort of payoff for that. There's something that's left out there, right? Why should you be ethical? Because it's the right thing to do. Not just because it will, you know, bring happiness to the greatest number, not just because it will produce, you know, profits for the stockholders, not just because it will make you feel warm and fuzzy inside, but for Kant, because it's the right thing to do and you recognize it as the right thing to do. So giving customers a fair price, if I'm giving them a fair price only because I want them to keep buying from me, so I'm being ethical, I'm being an ethical business person, but only because I want to preserve the contact that I have, I'm not really treating that person as an end in themselves. I'm not fully treating them as an end. I'm treating them more as a means. And I'm treating my own action, and I'm treating myself in a certain way, as a mere means to making more and more money or to assuring a constant cash flow. Kant would disapprove of that. Kant would say, if you're going to give people a fair price, you ought to be giving them a fair price because that's what they actually deserve. To recognize and to treat humanity as an end in other people would entail giving them a fair price, and not just because it's going to be good for business, not just so you can stay out of jail, not just because it makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside, not just because you happen to love these customers, but because it's the right thing to do. So I think that's a good example to close with. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.